The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, what I want to do is to try to address the issue as much as possible in an exegetical fashion, at least to keep our attention focused on key passages. And that means now, as we begin to reflect on the question of women in relationship to the office of elder, there are three passages that we can look at, or we need to focus on. 1 Corinthians 11, 2 through 16, and 1 Corinthians 14, 33b to 36, and then, of course, 1 Timothy 2. Key statements in the passage 8 through 15. And how I'll proceed here is in a first major section, let's call it A, I will make a number of observations. I think of them as orienting observations that would bear on all three passages, and then subsequently we'll move on and focus on each passage in order, and then finally, in a final section, draw some concluding observations. Now, I have a series, I believe, of five what we're calling orienting observations. First of all, within the New Testament, these three passages, we've singled them out because they are the major texts that deal explicitly, or at least more or less explicitly, with the relationship between men and women and their respective roles in the life of the church, and more specifically, the corporate or communal life of the church. As a result, because these passages have this character, the three of them, and more particularly the 1 Corinthians 14 passage and 1 Timothy 2, they have become crucial now in our time in the debate over women's ordination, especially ordination to the office of elder. These passages are usually perceived as addressing the issue more directly than any other text in Scripture. So that we have the situation, I don't want to be now putting this at all in a pejorative way, describing it even-handedly. It seems to me, on the one hand, those who argue against women's ordination find their most explicit support for that position in these passages. And alternatively, those who argue the contrary, argue for women's ordination, they then seek in various ways to show that these passages, in fact, do not exclude women's ordination. Now, secondly, particularly in the, I think the time frame would be about right, the last decade or so, these passages, the three, and then certainly most particularly 1 Timothy 2, these passages, particularly 1 Timothy 2, they have been scrutinized rather intensively in relationship to the issue of women's ordination. The result of that intensive scrutiny is an array of interpretive opinion, hypotheses, a spectrum of exegetical results that is bewildering, even overwhelming. Exegetical claim and counterclaim apparently without end. Now this situation, as we find ourselves coming into it, that I think places us in a rather a definite danger, and that is the danger that we will become stuck in this morass of conflicting interpretive opinions. We'll be become so bogged down in that we will, so to speak, no longer be able to see the forest, to keep perspective. So I think what we are called upon in this situation is to try for balance and to try as much as possible to lay hold in these passages of what they clearly teach, along with what is admittedly much even that is imponderable and uncertain. I don't want to exaggerate the imponderables, but they are there, as we'll see as we get into the passages. But without, I think we have to, while recognizing the uncertainties, we have to be careful that we don't become so engrossed with them that we lose sight of what these passages do teach fairly clearly. So the discussion that I want to conduct with you, while it will not attempt thorough exegesis, what I'll be trying to do is to grasp after that desired clarity. And to try to do that primarily by identifying boundaries, or more mathematically, parameters, guidelines for properly understanding these passages. So I would, as we make this second point, certainly want to make us aware and stress the fact that more exegesis, more argument is needed at a number of points, maybe even important points, although I tried not to shortchange what is important, but certainly more exegesis is needed than I will be giving here. And at a number of places, I am going to have to be more or less assertive rather than demonstrative or argumentative or whatever. In other words, I'm going to have to say things and not support them as much as you might like. Thirdly, so far we've made reference to current preoccupation with these passages, and as we look now at the current treatment and thinking particularly of 1 Timothy 2, it seems to me, as we look at the discussion, there are four basic positions that we can identify. And again, I hope to have done this in an even-handed way and not tilt the discussion by the way we define positions. The first position, we can express something like this. I've tried to get a formulation that will express things more or less in a parallel mode of expression so that the differences will be highlighted. First position, we could say, is that Paul, understood as the fallible man, Paul understood as fallible, intends an exclusion of women from ordained office that is absolute and perpetual. But Paul, as fallible, is wrong and therefore to be disregarded. A second position is that Paul is the inspired apostle, and as inspired, he intends, and therefore God intends, to exclude women from ordained office. Paul does here, as inspired, intend to exclude women from ordained office, specifically the office of elder. But that exclusion is necessitated solely by circumstances that are unique to the time of the original readers. Or at least this exclusion of women is necessitated by circumstances that are other than our own contemporary situation. So that on this second view, the exclusion then is limited in its applicability and is only temporary. By God's design, it's not relevant today, at least directly. It's not at least relevant directly, and therefore is no longer binding on the church. And as this position is further amplified, there is appeal to various cultural and or ecclesiastical and religious factors that show its strictly temporary limited character. So that this prohibition in 1 Timothy 2 on this view would be much like the head covering for women that is enjoined in 1 Corinthians 11 at 10, 13, and 15. Or a little farther afield, but another essentially similar consideration, the decrees of the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15. They are inspired, they have apostolic origin, but they're directed to a temporary situation that has passed away. That's the way this second position would argue. A third position, in its effect, close to the second, is that Paul is an inspired apostle. But as inspired apostle, he does not intend, and therefore God does not intend, to exclude women from ordained office. The issue on this view, the issue of office of ordination, is just not in view in these passages. With that, we can express the fourth view. And that is the view that Paul, the inspired apostle, intends, and therefore God intends, an absolute perpetual exclusion that is binding until Christ's return. Binding for the entire history of the church. Now, on the assumption of the divinely inspired origin and authority of these passages, the assumption I want to make now for the scope of our discussion, we can leave the first viewpoint to the side, that is that Paul excludes, but he was wrong. I'm saying on that assumption, it's only then the other three positions, 2, 3, and 4, as I gave them to you, that merit our consideration. And the issue is this. In these passages, is there an exclusion intended, an exclusion of women from the office of elder? Is there an exclusion intended? And if so, is that exclusion temporary or permanent? Fourth. All three passages of our concern are expressly didactic in character, and they include legislative elements. That's kind of abstract at this point. You'll see that clearly when we begin looking at them in turn. They're didactic, and in fact, as didactic, they're legislative. They prescribe. But at the same time, like all scripture, they are historically conditioned. They are, to use the word in its in a more technical sense, they are occasional. They are occasional. That's to say, they are addressed to specific problems in a particular time and place. Now, that occasional factor, the historically conditioned factor, which we are bound to recognize, that in no way prevents these passages from containing teaching of enduring validity. That's the wrongheadedness of much historical scholarship in dealing with the scriptures. To have shown the historically qualified character is immediately to have disqualified it from having any persisting, ongoing validity. That doesn't follow. But the occasional factor can be a source of difficulty in trying to identify precisely what that enduring validity is. we're faced with a question that could be put something like this. How are we to distinguish within these passages between abiding norms and what may be temporary? How are we to distinguish between what persists or continues to have normative force and what is a localized expression, a temporary localized expression of that norm? And notice, by the way, when we're talking here about abiding norms or enduring validity, I do not want that language to be understood in some kind of ahistorical sense. But we are talking about what is of enduring validity just in within the movement of history. What is trans-historical, what is trans-cultural, not supra-historical or supra-cultural. And there is, then, the difficulty of making that distinction. So, I think it's worth accenting here that to pose this question of what exactly enduring validity is, that is not a sign of weakened or abandoned a confidence in the authority of Scripture. But it's a question that is prompted by the text itself. Everyone, faithful to the text, has to wrestle with this question. Fifth of these preliminaries. Now, while these passages have become very focal in the discussion, it is in fact the case that none of them explicitly addresses the question of women's ordination. The accent here, of course, on the word explicit. In 1 Corinthians 11, the issue is women praying and prophesying. Apparently in public. We'll argue that in momentarily. But nothing there is said about office or ordination explicitly. Similarly, in 1 Corinthians 14 and 1 Timothy 2, the issue is women speaking and teaching in church, as Paul says, or in God's household, as he says somewhat beyond the passage in 1 Timothy 2 and 1 Timothy 3:15. As Warfield phrases it, in these passages, it is the publicity, not the formality of it, which is the point. So far as the speaking teaching, it's the publicity, not the formality of it, which is the point. Now, later on down, as I'm going to try to argue, I think we have to qualify that statement of Warfield in a significant way, but I think it makes the point here. That, by the way, is from an article that you want maybe to be aware of, Paul on Women Speaking in Church by Warfield. Paul on Women Speaking in Church that appeared in, I guess, some kind of weekly publication back in 1919. Most recently, it has been available by the Trinity Review. The Trinity Review, number 46, for December 85. So, we can go on here to put the matter this way. The time-honored conclusion, the conclusion which has been traditionally has traditionally taken hold in the church, and however we're going to judge that, I'm not at this point committing myself to that, just wanting to state the fact. The time-honored conclusion is that the passages in 1 Corinthians 14 and 1 Timothy 2 exclude women from ordained office as an apparently unavoidable a fortiori inference. They don't explicitly, the traditional position is that they don't explicitly they don't explicitly address the issue of ordination, but by inference they exclude women from ordination to the teaching office. Because, you see, women are prohibited from any speaking whatever in public gatherings of the church. Therefore, all the more, they're excluded from the ordained office of teaching in the church. That's the traditional reasoning on pastors. Now, with those opening observations, we can go on section B and look at the passage in 1 Corinthians 11. Are there any questions, especially for clarification, to this point? Yes. No, I won't. I will be bringing earlier exegetes, commentary writers like Calvin and Hodge into, but I guess Calvin is as far back as I've gone. Now, turn, if you will, to 1 Corinthians 11. And the key verses, be nice to spend more time on the context, but we can't. The key verses are verses 5 and 13. 5 and 13. I'll just have to be assuming here that this passage is not entirely unfamiliar to us. Paul says, Every woman praying and prophesying, every woman who prays or prophesies, or if she prays and prophesies, with uncovered head, dishonors her head. And again in verse 13, decide for yourselves, or judge for yourselves, and then a rhetorical question, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with uncovered head? Now, to work our way into drawing our own conclusions about the passage by referencing, taking note of some earlier positions, Charles Hodge, in his commentary, and in what Hodge has to say, he follows Calvin in the main. Hodge and Calvin, or we'll stick with Hodge. Hodge believes that Paul, here in these statements, is making a concession for the sake of argument. He doesn't approve of women speaking in church meetings, but, let me back up a second. Paul doesn't approve of women speaking in church meetings, as, according to Hodge, 1 Corinthians 14 and 1 Timothy 2 plainly show. But although he does not approve of women speaking, he concedes the existence of the practice here in the interest of highlighting his main point, what is the more important point that he has, and that is the impropriety of women praying and prophesying with uncovered heads. That's Paul's real, the burden of Paul's concern here. So that's the position of Hodge and Calvin, that Paul is involved here in a concession in the interests, without approval, in the interests of making a more basic point. But now Warfield, from the article that I already cited, perhaps elsewhere, I haven't checked that out. Warfield takes a different view. His approach is to emphasize the lack of clarity here in 1 Corinthians 11. And as at the same time, along with the lack of clarity, he says, and I'm quoting now, there is no reason whatever for believing that praying and prophesying in church is meant. So you see, Hodge and Calvin say, praying and prophesying in church is meant, but not approved by Paul. Warfield differs and says, there's no reason for believing that public or in church praying and prophesying is meant. Now, it seems to me that there are several substantial objections to both of these understandings. First of all, and there's three areas of comment that I want to make in interaction. I think if we read the passage on its own terms, now I know that's a question, that can be a question begging way of beginning an argument. What does it mean to read it on its own terms? But it can mean something, and without trying here to defend that, saying something like at least the surface reading, and more than that, its plain suggestion is that women praying, women prophesying in public meetings of the church are recognized and accepted practices of both. As far as I can see, there is nothing in the passage that even intimates disapproval by Paul. And so that we're taking a distance here from Hodge and Calvin. I think a more particular point that corroborates that, you have to recognize that the exact same language is used to describe the activity of men praying and prophesying in verse 4 as women in verse 5. And certainly there's no question of the propriety of men praying and prophesying. And I would say it's even more unlikely, unless I'm missing something, it's more unlikely, for reasons that I'll spell out in a few minutes, it's more unlikely that the passage is concerned with private activities, disagreeing now with Warfield. It seems further, it seems fair to me to say that Hodge and others reject these observations only because of what would result for them as a contradiction, because of the resulting contradiction with what they believe 1 Corinthians 14 and 1 Timothy 2 plainly teach. And that, of course, is an issue we'll have to keep in mind as we go along. Second, I think we have to note the fact that Paul repeats his reference to women praying. Not only repeats it, but he repeats it at a different point in his argument. He repeats it at a point where he's summing up. And I think there's at least some weight to this observation. The fact that he repeats reference to women praying at a different point in the argument, that weighs, put it the other way around, it counts against the idea that the reference is concessive. It weighs in the direction of showing that Paul sees this as an established and approved practice. Thirdly, we have this also to consider. Hodge recognizes that verse 5 takes for granted that women receive and exercise the gift of prophecy. He recognizes that. Further, as we've seen, his view is that the public exercise of the gift, not the gift itself, but the public exercise, is prohibited to women. That means, then, that presumably Hodge is left with the private exercise of the gift of prophecy for women. But to that we have to ask the question, what can that mean? A private exercise of the gift of prophecy. Because the overriding emphasis of chapters 12 through 14 on spiritual gifts that follows directly in the letter, insistent emphasis is that all spiritual gifts are given for the common good. For the common good. 12:7. For the edification of the church. 14:12. And further in chapter 14, the stress there is on the value of prophecy, the special value of prophecy, just in this respect of giving edification to all. So in view of these considerations, it seems to me we do have to say that the notion of private prophecy is a virtual contradiction in terms. And looks to be a kind of artificial abstraction. Our conclusion then on the 1 Corinthians 11 passage is this. These verses imply that in some form, prayer and prophecy by women was an accepted practice in the churches known to Paul. An accepted practice in the churches known to Paul. There is, you see, in verse 16, a reference to churches plural, which shows he has a somewhat wider scope. And perhaps it would be relevant to bring in here the reference that we find in Acts 21:9, to the four daughters of Philip, the evangelist, who were known by the fact that they prophesied. Now, with that, we can go to 1 Corinthians 14 passage. If there are any, I don't want too much to argue about 1 Corinthians 11 because we'll come back on that in effect, but go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, what it does allow, but what it does not allow.
Well, I think what 1 Corinthians 11 is concerned about is the uncovered head.
Yes.
Yeah, all right, that, I can't make that. That's a much debated issue. Is it hair as a given as a covering, or is it something that is actually put on the head? And I that is an issue I can't get into. So. Right. My own judgment would be that it's whatever the head covering is, it is a sign of authority that is picked up out of the sequence that the head of the woman is man. And but again, you know, just in the strict terms of our inquiry here, I don't think we have to settle that question, unless I'm missing something. Yeah, okay, right. Yes. Yeah, if that doesn't strike you, if you don't buy it, you don't buy it. And I wouldn't want to put that much weight on it. It strikes me the fact that he repeats it in the concluding statement. See, it's not just a reference he's made in passing, but he's made it again. And I don't think that's decisive in showing his approval, but I think it weighs in that direction. First Corinthians 14, and the verses particularly, we'll read beginning at verse 30, the middle of verse 33. you have a Greek text in front of you, you'll see how the, and maybe some of the English translations do it too, there's a really a paragraph break. The versification is not in the best place here. The proverbial horse must have lurched at the wrong point here, but if you don't get that allusion, I'm not going to explain it. takes it back to your New Testament introduction. As in all the churches of the saints, notice the generalization, let the women be silent in the churches, for it is not permitted to them to speak. Let them be in submission, as the law also says. If they wish to learn something, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it's shameful for a woman to speak in church. Or has the word of God gone out from you, or has it reached you only? Now, a series of two sets of observations here. I'll begin on this note. It's, I think, not as clear as some people at least think exactly what Paul is intending to forbid here. The passage itself, looked at just in its own terms, does present us with a sweeping prohibition on women speaking publicly, almost certainly women speaking in church. That sweeping prohibition would seem to be undeniable. So that with this verse, these verses taken together with 1 Timothy 2:11 and following, Warfield, for instance, says, puts it this way, and I'm quoting, "These two absolutely plain and emphatic passages that establish the exclusion of women from specifically the functions of preaching and ruling elders." But, now, just picking up on that position of Warfield, you see, he can assert that, he can assert, in other words, that there's such clarity about 1 Corinthians 14 only because, as we were just noting earlier, he considers 1 Corinthians 11 to be so unclear. So unclear that it can present nothing counterindicative. That is, 1 Corinthians 11 presents nothing that stands against the exclusion of women from public speaking, public praying, prophesying in church. Now, as we have tried to show, 1 Corinthians 11 clearly implies that some women were praying and prophesying publicly, and they were doing that with Paul's tacit approval. Now, assuming that, assuming what I at least have concluded from 1 Corinthians 11, and assuming further these two considerations, that Paul now is not contradicting himself three chapters later, and further, that the verses in chapter 14 that we've considered are not a non-Pauline gloss. And what I'm addressing here is a position that some of you may be aware of, that a number of critical scholars deal with the text by denying that Paul wrote them and seeing them whether at a later point in the chapter or here being inserted by another hand for which there's absolutely no textual evidence. Now, making all those assumptions, what we saw in 11 and what we don't want to assume here in 14, it follows then that chapter 11 limits the apparently absolutely absolute sweep of the prohibition that we have in 1434. That's the main point here. In some way, chapter 11 limits what, if we only had chapter 14, we would conclude is the absolute prohibition. Now, how does that happen? That raises a question, I think, again, that is just difficult to be decisive on. A number of explanations have been offered, and you can see them for yourself, most conveniently brought together, at least in my reading experience, in the book by James Hurley, Man and Woman in Biblical Perspective, pages 186 to 188. He gives options there. Now, in my judgment, none of the views that he lists there is entirely convincing. Probably the most satisfying view, which you see it's not a very strong way of putting it, probably most satisfying, is that in the light, when we take into view the immediately surrounding context, the verses in chapter 14 prohibit women specifically from participating in authoritative judging or evaluating of prophetic utterance. That the verses have to be understood in terms of the primary issue that Paul is addressing in the chapter, which is really a specific one of tongues and prophecy in their relative, in the relationship to one another, the relative superiority of prophecy to tongues. So the crux of what I'm trying to get at under this first point is how exactly the prohibition of chapter 14 is to be limited is not easy to answer. But that, the fact that the prohibition is not absolute, that seems to me a clear consideration that we have to draw in the light of 1 Corinthians 11 passage. There's a second point that if you can agree with its main, its foundational premises, I think will have a fair amount of weight for you and serve, as it were, to clear the 1 Corinthians 14 passage, give it a clear position in the debate. Now, as we were just noting, 1 Corinthians 14 have a specific concern. They deal specifically with prophecy and tongues and their exercise. The chapter as a whole, the whole long chapter, 40 verses, is structured by a comparison between these two gifts, and in the interest of showing that prophecy is of relatively greater value. That contrast, if you haven't seen this, take the time perhaps to just eyeball the passage, as it were. That contrast runs like a backbone down the entire the chapter as the argument there. We find it already in verses 2 and 3, and it culminates in the declaration of verse 39. Now, keeping that in mind, it would certainly be possible, I don't think that we could absolutely exclude, that in the verses of our concern, 33b through 36, it could be possible that Paul is momentarily digressing now from the central argument and is addressing another matter. That he's not really thinking here about prophecy and or tongues, but the issue of women in speaking in church. But it seems to me that that is just not likely. In view of the structure that we were just noting. And certainly there is nothing in the passage that would demand such a the notion of a parenthesis, a parenthetical excursion. Now I think that way of looking at things confirms that in these verses, whatever their precise meaning is now, in these verses, or that the verses are in some way related to the exercise of prophecy and or tongues. Now, if we recognize that the verses bear some way, in some way, prohibitions they involve, they include and bear in some way on prophecy in tongues. Then, recognizing it on that assumption, we can go on and make a further assumption that I think more careful study will show, and that is that prophecy in tongues are revelatory gifts that were confined to the apostolic age. Prophecy in tongues, see, this is where I'm just being assertive now. I'm not trying to argue what I recognize to be a most debatable and interrogable and whatever position. But it is a position I've tried to argue with some care in Volume's Perspectives on Pentecost, if I could get a plug-in for that at this point. On the assumption that these gifts were confined to the apostolic period of the Church's history, they don't continue today, we're brought then to the conclusion that 1 Corinthians 14, including the verses in question with their prohibition, they address a particular set of issues in a church situation, an apostolic church situation, that by God's design no longer exists. So you can see the drive of my, the direction of my argument here. What is said here about the exercise of prophecy in tongues, including verses 33 through 36, is not directly applicable to the church today. Now, for these reasons, then, I'm brought to the conclusion that 1 Corinthians 14, 33b through 36 has no direct bearing on the issue of women's ordination. But with that now, we come to 1 Timothy 2. 1 Timothy 2. And the situation in 1 Timothy 2, excuse me, 2, I was talking all weekend long and I had to lecture this hour before and it's catching up. The situation, I think, does stand in contrast now in the 1 Timothy 2 passage. It does differ significantly, as I'll try to show. And if these verses aren't already indelibly imprinted in your consciousness by the discussions of our time, let me read. We'll pick up at verse 11 in chapter 2, 1 Timothy. Paul is talking about the adornment of women, which is to be through good works. Let a woman learn in silence, in all submission. I do not permit a woman to teach nor to exercise authority over a man, but to be literally in silence in the church. For Adam was created first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and led into transgression. But she shall be saved through childbearing if she abide, if they plural, will be, if they remain in faith, love, and holiness with sobriety. Now, a number of points, and I guess it's probably in the best part of discretion or whatever not to try to get launched into that, and I can see now that probably on Wednesday we're not really going to be able to say much of anything about the office of deacon. I think in this discussion, as we are, we're going to have to focus there. Any questions before we get the bell about where we've gone so far? Yes. Yeah, I think that again, that raises a very difficult question. I don't know how you'd be. It seems, particularly to the reference to let them ask at home, that that is primarily in view, but I think it would be pushing too far to say that he has no concern for unmarried women here. But I think that would be, at the same time, I think you'd still be left with a question that would be difficult to answer. Did I say in church when I translated 1 Timothy 2? Well, I shouldn't have said that. I'm glad you caught me. We're talking about 1 Timothy 2:12.
Right.
Yes. That must have been... we won't comment further on what it must have been. I think the reference... we will want to bring into view the reference of to the household of God that's at the end of chapter 3, but thank you for that important correction.